Welcome back to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in today. Our website, as you know, is redicecreations.com, and we are here doing radio on Thursdays and Sundays. We have loads of other material available for you on our websites. We have webcasts, video content, members area, news, and much more, so do check it out. And today we have a really interesting program ahead of us. We have Nikki Rapana with us, all the way from Alaska. And we are going to talk about the Anti-Communitarian League. We are also going to talk, of course, then about the Communitarians, talk about their philosophy, so to speak, and kind of how this ties together a little bit with globalism, with individuality, liberty, and the emerging global government. And also I want to hear about what Nikki considers to be the philosophy or ideology behind all of this that we can see now emerging, as it were, in the world. And Nikki's website is simply nikirapana.com. That's nikirapana.com. And from there, you can find some more links to her blog and to the Anti-Communitarian League website. Okay, so with that, welcome to the program, Nikki. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this. I want to begin this program, Nikki, to define some terms here right away so people kind of can follow along in where we're coming from. If we're going to talk about the Anti-Communitarian League, we need first to, of course, understand what a or the communitarians are. I know that in the UK they have something called Common Purpose. Don't know if you've heard about them, but I've heard suggestions that we're dealing with kind of similar groups or at least ideologies here. But tell us a little bit about the communitarians, Nikki.
Okay, in my opinion, communitarianism is the philosophy behind the global government. It is the law being used in all integration for the European states. It's been defined under CAFTA, NAFTA, the emerging union in the Middle East, Africa, everywhere. It's everywhere. China uses it. Russia obviously uses it. All of the communist countries have already been incorporating communitarianism for a long time. The Eastern Germans are really familiar with some of the community policing tactics used to enforce communitarian law. But yeah, it's the global system. I call it the global bureaucracy and the philosophy and the law. So, for you know, if you talk to me about the global government, communitarianism is going to come up.
So it's a kind of a defining and overarching term to describe all of these things, basically.
Yes, and what they had planned on doing, as far as I can tell, is Amitai Etzioni is the founder of the Communitarian Network at George Washington University. Mm-hmm. And according to him, the idea just popped up and hit him in the head one day over lunch because the middle was not well represented. The left had its, vocal people, and the right has its vocal people, but the middle, he claims that most people are in the middle somewhere, so they wanted to represent them, and then he suddenly just came up with all these terms, according to him. That's why my thesis, The Historical Evolution of Communitarian Thinking, is a direct rebuttal to Etzioni's claim that he just came up with communitarianism sometime in the late 80s.
So there's something... continue.
Well, you can go back and find the term communitarian used as far back as Communitarian Ra in Egypt. It showed up again at different times over the last 2,000 years. I found it in the Vatican archives of something about the confirmation of Christ or something in 300 AD. And then I've seen it again. There was a communitarian church at the same time that the communist manifesto was written in 1848. There was a whole communitarian, a guy named Barmby. I have a bunch of stuff about him in a couple articles I've written, that they had used the term before. It's been around, but it just sort of dies out. And then it was reintroduced again under Martin Buber in 1950 or so out of Jerusalem after Israel got its independence. That's who Etzioni studied under. And then it was reintroduced in upper academia in the late 70s, early 80s, and then by the late 80s, Amitai Etzioni had introduced it to not upper academia, but middle upper academia, and in the White House, you know, and very influential people use all of the philosophy to implement programs. It's about change. In fact, Obama's change is definitely a communitarian change.
Oh, really? Huh.
But so is McCain and Palin's.
So we're surrounded here, as it were, right?
Yes, we are. We are surrounded. It's to me, I find it everywhere. I go study the Columbia Plan, Plan Columbia, and I find communitarianism. I study the Philippines Local Agenda 21, and there's communitarianism. It's in every local Agenda 21 plan. In fact, it is the philosophy for the entire United Nations Sustainable Development Plan. And it's also a law in the European Union. You can look it up under it. And most of it now has been transferred and it's called community law. So community is another word for communitarianism.
Oh. And Amitai Etzioni, tell us a little bit more about this guy. Is it a background in Yale, is it?
Pardon me?
Does he have a background in the Yale? Or has he gone
Yale?
To the school? Yeah, at Yale?
Yes, he was, within 10 years of, he graduated with his master's from Berkeley. And I've been doing a little bit more reading about going back to things that I read that he wrote before and seeing how they're modifying it.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty much writing out his entire military history as an Israeli revolutionary and a soldier in the war against the seven Arab states in 48. In fact, his studies under Buber have been, you know, they're played down now too. Basically, he came to the United States in like 1954, I think, got his master's from Berkeley in sociology, and then he taught at Columbia University in New York in the sociology department, and then within 10 years he was the head of the department. He's got a long bio. Man's been active in the New World Order Project since around 64, I think.
Uh-huh, right.
So, yeah. And then in 1979, he came in under Richard Hardin, special assistant to President Carter, and began advising Carter on the kinds of programs that Etzioni's introduced, are character education, the faith-based initiative, Volunteer America, Citizen Corps, the requirements. He calls it the balance between our rights and our responsibilities. It's global citizenship. It's the rules for global citizenship mostly.
And
in the back end, other things.
Yes, and is he, let's see here, is he, do you know if he's still alive today?
Yes.
He is.
Yes, he's teaching. He's the an instructor, a sociology instructor, and an avid lecturer. He goes all over the world lecturing. You know, he's been invited to The Hague. He's on committees to regulate the internet, to tax the internet.
There we go.
Yeah, he's written like 30 books now. My website is 3 years old, the stuff, I mean, on Etzioni, and at the time it was 26 or 27, so he's written a few books since then, and they're used by every government in the world.
So this is one guy who supplies the emerging global government, if you will, of its ideology, if we can look at it that way. And if we're talking a little bit, let's talk a little bit more about communitarianism and just define kind of more what it is, actually is all about. You mentioned that it has its roots. Would you say that, for instance, that it's more leaning towards the left, or is this the kind of the golden middle path of these guys in order to merge both the right and the left and get everyone under the same umbrella here? Extrapolate on it for us.
Well, to them it's the ultimate synthesis. It has been an ongoing process of merging the false left, I call it, with the false right, so that they can achieve the false middle. so to me, it's a completely ridiculous argument, but it's working very well. And the more people that follow the false left that will come out and fight against the false right, then the solution is always their middle. And they're saying that, well, we can't please everyone, so we'll please, you know, what they're doing is balancing. Balancing is one of their key terms. Balancing national law against international law. balancing individual rights against community rights. So
it's, you know, it sounds to me like this is like they're this is a way for them to bring in the new world order structure with it, with a set of cotton mittens. You know, it's like this is not going to be a hard, difficult thing that people are going to, you know, really kind of feel the implications of, in that sense, that they're more going to, it's going to be kind of snuggled up against them, so that it will catch us on unguarded, so to speak. And this is something that is sounds like it's very, very soft, but it's seeking the middle way, and yet at the same time, if it would go into full effect or full force, what kind of situation would you think that we would end up in then, politically and economically?
Under this system of government?
Yes.
Absolute totalitarian fascist control. And what that means is, to me, okay, is that the government will have the enforcement power and the corporations will have the employment and economic power. It's called the public-private partnership. It's a brilliant plan. It really is, on every level, because where the government is restrained from having files on private citizens in the United States, the Privacy Act of 1974 here was real clear about what kind of files the government could keep, what kind of information they could have, how it would be stored, who was allowed to share it, et cetera, et cetera. And then it was enacted into law under U.S. Code 552A. And this is what got me started, actually, in all my work, was because the new system of government in Seattle said that they needed more data on all the private citizens that lived there. You can't have a safe and healthy community unless you know everything about everyone who lives there.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
Right. Huh. So it's like preemptive. It's the Bush Doctrine at the local level. If they know about me and they know that I have a potential for criminal behavior, or I have a potential for alcohol or drug addiction, or I have the potential for abusing my children, then the new government intervenes on me before I do these things. And how the only way they can do that is if they have a complete and total database of every living person and thing. It's just not people too, you know, it's everything, it's every plant, every all the water. They've already cataloged everything on the planet, and now they're convincing us that they are better equipped scientifically and morally, that in order to save the planet and to create a peaceful and healthy world, we have to give in a little. Okay, it's not a lot. They make it sound good, you know, giving up a little bit of rights.
Huh. And, you know, this also sounds like actually it's tying in a lot with the technological advancements, because as you're talking, I'm imagining this, futuristic type world where actually everything is more tracked, more monitored, more regulated. We're talking about RFID chips everywhere, surveillance going in. Do you think that this, the rise of all of these things have been... been happening basically because of a communitarian type philosophy? It lies behind the governments today.
Yes, and that's what I've spent 10 years putting on my website, is all the quotes, all the, you know, the books that they've written, all of the ways that they define it. What I had to do for myself, okay, is I can understand modern communitarianism. I can identify all their language. I can look at a plan and tell you exactly where they got the information. But what I wanted to understand for myself was the philosophy and how they're justifying this. How City of Seattle could tell me that my rights have been balanced, because I'd never heard of it. And when you go back and study some of their philosophers, which, you know, you can go back all the way to the beginning of written history, okay? Aristotle's got stuff on it. They use Plato. I had to really, you know, knuckle down and just start reading stuff that was way over my head in the beginning. I had a little bit of background. I took one class in existentialism in college. So I had already attempted to read Hegel in 82. And to tell you the truth, you know, I tried to make my daughter read him and say, you know, you need to read him. He's important.
Right, yeah.
They base everything on him, you know, and nobody can understand Hegel, you know. And if they claim that they do, they're lying. I had a professor in Frankfurt write and tell me that only 12 people in the world you know, and they're native German speakers can actually understand Hegel. And he was reassuring me that Amitai Etzioni isn't one of them.
Okay, right.
So, you know, for us to, I mean, how dare us as little laymen, two little women from Seattle, to sit down and write a thesis called What is the Hegelian Dialectic? And that's what we ended up doing because it's such an important part, this thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, you know, comes from a lot of his writings. And people will call it, they'll reference Hegel, and they'll call it the Hegelian Dialectic. But then if you ask them, what is the Hegelian Dialectic, you know, they have a hard time explaining it because it was just written to be totally confusing.
Hmm.
And that's what we've seen in it, is that it was, it's like when they asked me in Seattle, don't you want to live in a nice neighborhood? They set up the choice for me to say, my only answer, because I didn't want to be in their database and I didn't want the new government to intervene and help me, that I didn't want a mental health officer to come to my door and interview me to see if I had any mental problems.
Right, of course, you know? Yeah.
But that meant to them, you know, I could say, I don't agree with your program, and their answer to that was, don't you want to live in a nice neighborhood?
Yeah.
Don't you want to be part of a good community? So if I said no, then I look like someone who wants to live in a bad community.
Mm-hmm.
It was brilliant. It shuts you right down, right on the spot. You're like, I don't know what these people are talking about.
Right.
So I started asking them for definitions of the terms, and that's what led me to Etzioni, but it took a year to find those phrases, you know, and where they were coming from, because they all could repeat them, but none of them knew what the heck they were talking about.
So these people are obviously being trained somewhere. Do you think this training occurs on a specific level, a specific institutions that handle these people, this terminology, or is this basically so rampant throughout entire society now, so you just have to go through the regular school system to get the same level of indoctrination? Thoughts?
I think it's come all the way down to the lowest levels now. I mean, the children in the elementary school down the road are being thoroughly indoctrinated under Earth Charter, Earth Worship, you know, saving, preserving the beautiful wilderness. And, you know, there's a lot of levels where they're teaching people. Stop Common Purpose in the UK, Brian Garrish and those guys, they've sent me quite a bit, actually, and they do understand the communitarian philosophy very well,
mm-hmm,
and how it's being taught. I know people are trying to find Stop Common Purpose in the United States, but you don't have to look for it. It's called the Communitarian Network at George Washington University, and these classes are being taught. Vassar College had a sociology class called Quality of Life. You know, it's at all the academic institutions in the United States.
Hmm.
Find it everywhere. Some places they actually study the law and call it communitarian law, but mostly that's in Europe and Asia and South America.
Hmm. Let's go back a little bit and just talk about the Hegelian dialectic in another sense. Then, how would you define it then, if you were to do your best, to give your best shot at it, so to speak?
Okay, my definition, I guess my short version of it would be, it's total BS. The longer version would be, if you don't get it, that means you got it.
Okay, so the purpose is that you shouldn't get it. It's very Zen, then, I guess, in a way. Yeah.
So that you feel stupid. Everything they've written, and the 19th century was full of dialectical writing. It's killed lots of people.
What do you think that is? Is that to Orwell's doublethink? Is that what this is about here? Having two contradictory, you know, thoughts in your head at the same time? What's up here?
Well, it's kind of that, kind of two contradictory thoughts. But what it is it beats down your natural instincts for survival, because what they're up against is human survival is. Instincts are, you know, still pretty powerful, okay? So anything that doesn't sound good or doesn't look good to people, like the Irish, for instance, when they voted down the Lisbon Treaty.
Yeah.
The reason most people left at the polling that were polled as they were leaving, the reason they gave was that it was too long, they couldn't understand it, and anything that they couldn't understand that was that long couldn't be good for the Irish. I loved it. I'm like, perfect, that's exactly it. If you can't understand something, then it's not good for you.
Mm.
And the purpose of the, don't be on call. And that was a good one, you know?
Yep.
Because it is. It's the way that they do it. It's the way they set you up to give in to their demand. But they don't really want to put a gun to your head. They will if they have to, okay? They're
right.
showing that in Iraq, Afghanistan, you know,
yep.
lots of places, okay?
Yep.
But they would much rather, especially the countries that contribute large tax dollar base, okay, which would be the U.S., U.K., there's a lot of places, you know?
Mm.
And we're still contributing, people are paying for all this. So they want us to embrace it as our new ideology, as the way that the best solution to global poverty, climate change, whatever, you know, they have, and they have all their new science is also based in the Hegelian dialectic. It's the root. Communitarianism is the ultimate synthesis that Marx couldn't name, that Hegel couldn't name. No one's ever been able to name the final solution beyond communism, really, you know. And I was just reading some other stuff, though, that they confuse it a lot. And so what happens to people when you start reading 19th century, you know, writing, you're confused. You know, look, existentialism, when I took that class, I wanted out of that class.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so painful. I must have read Nietzsche, you know, this passage I was supposed to understand. I read it 100 times, and I went to my teacher and said, I'm too stupid. You got to let me out of this class.
Okay.
And I don't get it.
Mm.
And he made me stay. And I felt inadequate the entire time. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's done academically for people is that if everyone else is pretending, Sam for his new clothes, everyone else is pretending like they get it, okay? And you're going to be the only person in the room that says, but I don't understand. They don't expect that. And then if you do say that about any of their theories in a public meeting when you're questioning a new law or in a classroom where you're questioning the theory that the professor just explained, they have really good tools of manipulation are built into the Hegelian dialectic so that they can use that against you on the spot and twist it around and make you feel stupid or inadequate for even asking the question.
Hmm.
So what you have is a world full of people that are embarrassed that they don't understand what's going on. And you know, I wrote one of my earliest articles was ask your stupid questions because they're the right ones to ask.
Well, absolutely, I definitely agree there. It's about all, you know, you have to dare to ask the questions and put the authorities, so to speak, there on the spot and actually try to get some clear answers there. And I definitely agree with that. But I mean, are you saying here that, like, you know, 19th century, you know, philosophy is all, you know, It's too difficult for us to understand, or is it just, you know, BS all of it, or what do you mean?
Well, I to me it's BS because it's been used to infiltrate my life. Okay, I could have cared less whatever, you know, whether I remember when I realized that it was being worth versus nothing that the main Nietzschean who else went off on that? Dostoevsky, you know, there were several of them that really embraced the go inside and find the depths of your depravity and nothingness. And then when you reach nothing, then and only then you begin to really live, you know?
Yeah, right.
I was like, wow, that's intense, you know? So is that BS? Well, what did it do for my education? What did it do for the way that I think, okay? I think what it does is rob you of your instinct. All of a sudden you're like, well, is that my depraved side? I don't know. And yeah, I don't know. I found it to be, and I've seen it in a lot of students. I've seen it in a lot of really bright high school students that grew up with my daughter that went into college in their first year of college. They take a sociology class and they all feel like they're suicidal practically, you know, because now they feel it's so inadequate. Well, I just think that that's part of the psycho, you know, there's this whole, okay, it's sorcery, it's magic. These are words that can make you change the way you feel about yourself.
Mm, yeah.
And that's part of it, you know. So the game on every level is to make you give up your sovereignty, your individual sovereignty and your national sovereignty. Those are the two things that they say are the they're the problem. They're a world problem. They're the cause of global poverty. They're the cause of everything.
Could it also not be that, you know, philosophy overall isn't for everyone? You know, in that regard, that the mistake, so to speak, here might be to think that this is something that is suitable for everyone. Just as you say, you talk about very much about just, you know, primarily our drives, our needs as human beings should, you know, be there in place first. But then, who seeks for something more beyond that? I reckon that would be something interesting and giving for that person to go into and study some of the other philosophies and see what the heck they have to say, and then see if if it's applicable to yourself. But could it be that this idea that everyone should read this, everyone should be trained in this type of thinking, that is actually what is bad here? What do you think?
Yes, I agree with you. I'm glad you clarified that for me, because I'm going to get a ton of email now from people who are like, what are you talking about? You're so full of it, you know? I think that it's, they've written maybe a million books that are all leading to where we're at today.
Right.
And to me, it's like every one of them's a rabbit hole too, okay? I made the big mistake of saying, I want to understand the philosophy. You know, I should have stayed away from that. But in the end, it was good.
Okay. Well, you've learned a tremendous amount, have you not? You know,
in order for me to understand communitarianism as the synthesis in the Hegelian dialectic, which is what they say it is, okay?
Mm-hmm, right.
Everything that I say, okay, about Hegel being BS, that's me. Okay?
Exactly, yeah. Yep.
They don't say that.
Of course not.
But everything else I say about communitarianism, I learned from them. Mm. Except for my thesis, obviously. The Anti-Communitarian Manifesto is real clear about what we think they're doing with it and why it was created, how it was created. I would change a few parts of it today, you know, and we wrote it almost 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm,
and it's been online, and over 4,000 people have responded to my poll and told me why they've been there. I've had professors look at it. I've had academic review boards look at it. I think it's pretty sound, you know,
mm-hmm,
which is really scary, because that means we're right. And if we're right, then all of this other stuff, it's almost like I wanted to move on from it, you know, because how they got us here isn't as important to me as we're here now. What are we going to do now? Because that's the main question that people write and ask me, okay?
Sure, yeah.
How does this apply to me? And the problem is that every religion has been communitarianized, every one of them. Some of them may have begun as communitarian institutions. I don't even know, you know?
Mm.
The New Age is a big piece of this.
Yes.
A lot of the New Age ideology. Just about, and so your Christian community is faced with some really awful things that they have to look at, and yet many of them remain Christian, which I totally respect. I have friends in Seattle who are very New Age, and they're wonderful people, you know. In fact, Michael Sarian knows one of them, you know, and this is a really giving, generous human being. I never wanted to challenge his belief system, okay? I never wanted to say this is part of the global government belief system too, because what I understand is that what the system is doing is it has a piece of everything in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it has feminism, big time feminism in it, you know. And I, you know, even though I understand how feminism has been used, I always thought I was one, you know. So there's it's like one guy said on a forum somewhere about my work, it looks like I'm against everything. It was hard for him to find what I was for.
Right, right.
Because I'm against everything. Well, for a long time, I didn't know how big it was, or that everything that I started reading, the peace movement, communitarian, you know? I mean, it's like, is there anything out there that doesn't have it in it? Well, now I can't find anything. Now my goal is kind of to find anything that hasn't been influenced by communitarian thinking.
Well, I mean, isn't it, in a way, with that idea in mind, that why should we even be for something or willing to join something or sign up to an ology or an ism, right? You know, this is all about this is my life. You know, I'm here for, you know, whatever reason, you know, through evolution or the creator or what have you. And this is, you know, my life, and I'm going to live it the way I want to do. But, you know, why should we sign up to anything else? What anyone else is trying to tell us to do or get us to go along with anything? And it's really, it doesn't matter what we're for, like individuals, at least. It's more about what you say here. And I would agree with that, that, you know, I would only try to, you know, scope out what I'm not interested in, basically, you know.
Right. And I think what's the most brilliant part of the dialectic is that the more fervent your belief in something, the better a tool you are for them.
Hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. That's an interesting idea. And you know, let's backtrack a little bit and talk about, you mentioned, for instance, there the anti-communitarian League Manifesto. Is it short? Is it very long? Tell us about it. What is it?
Well, the part one is, what is the Hegelian dialectic? And it's a tutorial that we wrote, started writing it for my father, who was having a hard time following the articles I was writing in 2000, you know, and I really wanted him to help me and read my stuff and try and, you know, help me in Seattle, actually, when I was actually fighting the community government there in person, at their meetings, at their offices, at their hearing and reviews, at their, I mean, I was heavily involved in lawsuits, did a lot of research for that. So I thought he would help me. So he couldn't understand why it was going on. That was the main thing that people kept saying to me in the beginning was, why would they want to do this? This is so ridiculous. Why do they want to do it? And I didn't know why. So when I started finding stuff referring to Hegel and understanding thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and writing that, well, then, you know, anyone who hasn't taken a class in philosophy is not going to understand that at all. It makes no sense to them. So we went and wrote the tutorial, and we put it online when we challenged the Communitarian Network and the American Sociological Association in 2002 to dispute our thesis, and we included that. That was part of what I wrote to Estione and published it online, and then thousands of people went to it. Mm-hmm. And I kind of went, oh, no. So we rewrote it. I got a tutor, Professor Crawley, University of Wyoming, was one of the few. In fact, he was the only professor that wrote back. I wrote the heads of every political science department that I knew of. I wrote my mentor at UMass Amherst, Howard Ziff, Professor Howard Ziff. A lot of people that I had years ago been in contact with, trying to find someone to read what I was writing and help me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of begging in those days. So I did get some good help on, you know, the difference between inductive and deductive reasoning and the periods of thinking and how it evolved within the academic community. But part two, the historical evolution of communitarian thinking, was my direct rebuttal to Etzioni for his claims that communitarianism just popped in his head at lunch one day with Robert Galston, as opposed to a very methodical philosophy that's been implemented through all the sciences, including political science,
mm-hmm.
and every other one, you know, to the present day, where now all the scientists that have good jobs, okay,
mm-hmm.
not all scientists agree, but the ones that are paid by them totally, you know, repeat the party line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a training at the highest levels, and then these are the teachers, you know?
Right.
And they're facilitators. There's a couple colleges I've identified, particularly in England, you know, connected to the Fabian Society, and they've spread out all over the world, and there's others too, you know, but...
Would you say the Fabians are a big part of this?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes. Amitai Etzioni was trained in Fabian ideology.
Hmm, right.
He admits that. In fact, the first time I heard the term Fabian was when I was reading one of his biographical articles, and he said his Fabian beliefs had led him to leave in peace.
Okay, well, there we go. And for those who don't know at all about the Fabians, give us just a brief overview of these guys.
It was founded by Beatrice and Sidney Webb in London in the 1800s, like 1884 or somewhere around in there, to promote international Marxism, global government, via propaganda and lies, as opposed to overt violent revolution. And their plan was to infiltrate governments and introduce their ideology slowly.
Yes.
What they've been doing for 100 years, yeah.
Yes, then I think the name Fabian comes from that, a famous battle between Fabian and one of the emperors, I think, of the Roman Empire. Correct me if I'm wrong there, I don't know, but he was known for his patience, was he not?
Yes.
Yes, okay, so these are patient people. They're slowly going to incrementally bring this in. And, you know, okay, so we have a difference here, you know, in regards to where they have rather than you and them have a difference in how to bring this about, how to manage, I guess we can say, rather, a society overall. I mean, one thing that comes to mind here, of course, do you think that it could be that these people sincerely believe that this is the only sound and workable solution, so to speak, in regards to how to manage and administrate a society overall, and that they're actually thinking in of their own mindset that they're doing something really great? Would you say that is the main ideology here, or you know, this is what they think they're doing?
Well, I think that there's different levels in their hierarchy. At the top, I'm sure they're laughing at the higher levels, but yet not, you know, the very high reaches. I think that they're more moral. Everything they say they do is because they're more moral and that they care more about the world. So everything they write leads me to think that they are convinced of their superior breeding, that their elitist backgrounds give them a moral, you know, it's a manifest destiny for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That they have to do this. So have they convinced themselves at almost every level that they're doing the right thing? Yes, they have. I've had a lot of people approach me through the communitarians, that obviously believe in that, and they've tried to convince me that I'm a communitarian or that it really is the only way to save the world.
You're right, right, yeah.
So yes, I think they do. And I think at the lower levels, the general population that supports their measures, they want to do something good. I think that's what makes it so evil.
Well, I see what you mean.
People who really care and really want to do something good are stuck right into something really, really bad.
Right, right. And they're working. They also bring in the energy, so to speak, of the positive attitude, like, yeah, let's do something, let's change things, and they got all this energy to go to work for these other guys who actually might not have the best interest at heart for us, so to speak, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's like some of the best people that I've met in the last 10 years have to be the London Anarchist group that I met during WTO.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were definitely the most literate. They had the best arguments on the street. Of course, nobody published them except for, you just got to see them in flyers. But it was really, really sad because at the time I was working in property rights and they were in Seattle destroying property.
Mm-hmm.
And, saying things like, crush all the nations, we are the anarchist generation and stuff. And I didn't really get what they were talking about. I just liked them as people. They were very energetic, dedicated to their cause, dumpster divers, the whole bit. And they were helping. They're helping the WTO.
Yeah, of course.
And I think I'm actually glad that I didn't know that at the time, because people used to laugh at me and my work because I was so small town, All I was working on was my neighborhood plan, and at the time I didn't know it was a UN local agenda 21 neighborhood plan, and I didn't know anything about the global government. I'd never heard the term sustainable development, community development, community policing, nothing. I didn't know any of that. So most of what I did in the beginning was just read and listen and ask for definitions.
Yes.
And look where it led.
And you know, let's talk about this thing of, you know, what if we can get to the root of this in a way of what specifically it is in the ideology that you are against in that sense. I mean, in regards to they're trying to manage society in their way. You know, we can say that they're trying to, you know, change it. And in one regard, I personally myself have always kind of had this philosophy when looking at society at large that it actually it's their system in a way. They set it up. I wasn't part of it in that sense, or even you know, even if I look back in the family record or what have you. I mean, I know that my family hasn't been involved in like building these communities or even building the cities in a way. We're more like occupants within it. We're living in their system. So my philosophy has always kind of been to, you know, in a way they can actually do whatever it is that they're doing. The option I have is to actually opt out of their control society all together and try to find some other way to live my life. Do you think that that's like an option here, or you know, what specifically is it that you're against that they're doing at this point in time?
What I'm specifically against is that they're in the United States, okay? Because I can only speak for what's happening here.
Yeah.
Is I know that I was born into their lie. I was born in 1956, and I've been living under their laws and their lie ever since, you know, it was here before I was born. So the fact that I was trained to be on the right by my family. My dad was career military. I grew up a flag waving patriot, you know.
Mm.
Then I go to college, and my dad says I become a socialist because suddenly I'm introduced to all kinds of left ideas that actually made sense to me, okay? I followed Nicaragua closely. I wrote a video documentary on economic policy in Central America in 84 under the Reagan administration, you know. I was following Ollie North and the Iran arms for drugs scandals later. And, you know, so my sympathies were always with the socialists on the uprising side, Nicaragua, mm-hmm. even Cuba after a while. I started quoting Castro, you know.
Right.
So my dad freaked out, okay. And I did too, because it was like, it was like the total opposite. And then suddenly America were the bad guys. The CIA mining the harbors in Nicaragua. What the heck is going on? Publishing books on how to assassinate public officials. I was shocked, okay? I was shocked at what the American government was supporting and what they were doing. I thought we supported genuine people's revolutions. I didn't understand that any of it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I had a rude awakening. So when I finally realized, though, that what was happening was that I was supposed to choose either the right or the left. There wasn't supposed to be any middle until they introduced it as the solution.
Hmm.
And what I did was find out about the middle before I was supposed to really know what it was.
Right.
Okay, so that's where I've been for 10 years, writing about this, going, you know, this is what they're already doing. They were already balancing the laws. It's not something they're trying to do, Henrik.
Sure.
They've done it.
Absolutely. And it is a little bit what I said there. They've been doing it from day one because society is built on these same principles, are they not?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
In fact, there's evidence that the United States was created for this purpose expressly.
Okay. Hmm.
You know, and that's Bobby Garner's research. I'm not, you know, well-versed enough to really go into it, but there's some good stuff there. The Pilgrim Society is one that I wasn't...
Yes.
I haven't done any research on them. And then there's a book called The Union Jack, which is real important, and Sir Francis Bacon and what was going on with Elizabeth I.
Yes,
know?
Yes.
There's a lot. So, and then it goes back further, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
That's where you get into the Masonic stuff, the Illuminati, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, the Free and Accepted, you know, the connections between Prussia and France and the United States against England, you know. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, I'm thinking back of that idea when we have, you know, communist dictator like Castro is like shaking hands with, his boss and grandmaster of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, Andrew Berti has passed away right now, but, you know, we have pictures of them standing there and doing their handshake, you know, and it's like, okay, wait a minute here, you know, here's one guy from the left, and there's another one from the seemingly, you know, more conservative right, as it were, or, you know, with branches within the Vatican, you know, and things like this. What's going on here? You know, there's a common unity above this, you know, facade that we're looking at, you know?
Yeah.
And
that's where they can totally label you a conspiracy theorist and shut down all your research in a heartbeat. Actually, you don't even have to go there. They labeled me a conspiracy theorist just for asking about the law.
Okay, yeah, there you go.
So you might as well write about Masonry.
Well, exactly.
You know, because they're throwing you down that road anyway. And, you know, that's the murky connection. That's the Jesuits have their own secret societies, too. There's a lot of secret societies involved.
Yeah.
And maybe they're all connected somehow. I don't have a clue. But, yeah. And, you know, the American Revolution and the French Revolution, this was amazing to me as an American student who's also, I've done very well in history my whole life. I didn't know any of it. I didn't understand von Steuben was part of the same, you know, society as George Washington, or all of George Washington's officers were Masons. No, you know, we are not told that in school.
No.
So I found that fascinating.
Absolutely. And so this is what you've been doing here, in a way, then you could say, is that you've come to this area from a really interesting perspective, just from a kind of an honest, you know, searching for just some answers. You know, it's like, what the heck is going on here? Where are we going? And why are we in the position we're in, right? And then all of these things are keeping, you know, popping up, same, you know, you have secret societies popping up here and there, allegiances, you know, across the left and the right dialectic, as it were, that they're given to us within the political milieu, for instance. But, you know, if we look at some of the things that they have done and what they potentially are going to do in the future and look at their plans, so to speak, how far along do you think we are in their plans? Are we like really closing up here now to the final structure is going to be in place, and you know, 10 years from now we're going to live in this global dictatorship that you mentioned here? What do you think?
Well, it seems to be 2020 is one of their favorite years for their visions. They call them Vision 2020.
Mm.
Anchorage 2020 is, you know, just one of the many plans I've studied that have the word 2020, and that's why we call it our book, 2020, Our Common Destiny. So I think, yeah, I think we have about 12 years before the, you know, they're supposed to be ready. See, what we're seeing now, Henrik, is the groundwork is being laid.
Mm-hmm.
The bureaucratic structure has already been introduced in all the cities across America. And I'm, you know, from what I'm learning from Paul Barnes, our co-contributor to the book, in Canada, same thing there. And then people from England write and say the same thing is happening here, only it's more advanced. And within the European Union, whatever I read about the European Union is they're establishing the case law, you know, and establishing the courts. Once they have that completed, I don't think they're going to do their big takeover until they have their whole system built from the ground up.
Well, it's the way I look at it is that it's not going to be like a big takeover, like one step where we actually can see it, you know, okay, there it happened, because it's taken care of so incrementally. So we're blind to it because it spawns over hundreds of years, this process, right?
Yes, and we're already under it. Our people in this, even around here, independent Alaskans, okay?
Mm.
First of all, they're falling for Sarah Palin.
Yeah, there you go.
Don't know anything about her. And then, you know, on the other hand, I had a, we're having trouble finding wood in my neighborhood, you know, and I live on 22 million acres of forest and mountains, and we can't get wood. I just think that's nuts.
That is
they're
nuts.
They're tying it all up with the Indians, you know, they're giving it all back to the Indians. And they're putting no trespassing signs everywhere.
Okay.
I mean, you can't get nowhere on these back roads.
If we revert this, of course, I mean, we know that the suppression of Indians is taking place, but now it's in reverse then. So now the European descendants, as it were, or what have you, are their rights are being taken away now as well. Is that what's going on here?
Yes, everybody's rights are being taken away. I mean, the idea that they're giving it to the Indians is just another front, you know, to lock up the land. And, like, this goes back to your question. Can you get outside of it? Can you choose to abstain from participation in the global government? No. They got the land.
Yeah.
Where are you going to go?
That's true. Absolutely true. And, you know, Nikki, what I want to do is I want to continue talking here in our next segment, in our member section, and talk more about this and what we can do and about the land, of course. I want to talk about more how you would, you know, run society if you get a shot to do that, or even if you would be willing or whatever, your ideas and theories about that. I want to talk a little bit more about Agenda 21, also the European Union, and a whole lot more. But before we stop here and take a short break, I want you to mention your websites again, of course, and you mentioned your book, A Common Destiny 2020. How would people go about getting a copy of that if they're interested in finding out more about your work?
Right now, it's only available at the Anti-Communitarian League website. That's nord.twu.net. And from there, you can get to most of the writings. And we've just published our first edition of the Anti-Communitarian Manifesto, and we'll be mailing it out in about 2 weeks to the people that have pre-ordered it. And we did that from a lot of people started asking for more hard copy stuff. I just put everything for free online, you know, for a long time. 2020, Our Common Destiny, is a condensed version of the basic understanding of communitarianism, the law, Local Agenda 21, and Vision 2020.
Very good. So again, the website there is nord.twu.net, and I will have this linked up again on Red Eye, so you can find these links easily. And from there, you can find a whole lot more writing. You can find the links to the books and so much more there. Thank you very much for this segment, Nikki. Stay with us, then. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
All right. Thank you.
Join us in our members section for the continuation of our conversation with Nikki Rapana. We're going to talk more about the communitarian ideology, and if there are any alternatives, if you don't want to be a part of their system anymore, and if there's any places left where you can go. We'll also discuss the concept of Big Mother and their depopulation goals, who will make it and who will not. So head on over to our website, redicecreations.com. Click on subscribe. You'll get instant access when you sign up and tune in. We have so much material for you in our members area, so do take advantage of it. It's growing all the time. I also want to remind you about our Halloween special with Christopher Morse, Red Eyes Live, our webcast on Friday the 31st. All times and details will be available on our front page. Join us on our justin.tv channel. We have a chat box there, so you can follow along, and we might take some questions during the show, so do check that out. And to finish up here this segment and to lead into the next one, we're going to listen to the speech that Howard Roark gives in his in the movie The Fountainhead. So listen up, an excellent speech coming up here. But more with Nikki Rapana coming right up in our member section. Thank you very much. Talk soon.
I solemnly ask of every man who hears this case to let his own mind pronounce a verdict upon it. You have heard the testimony of the state's witnesses. The confession of Peter Keating has made clear that Howard Roark is a ruthless egoist who has destroyed Cortland Holmes for his own selfish motive. The issue which you are to decide is the crucial issue of our age. Has man any right to exist if he refuses to serve society? Let your verdict give us the answer. The state rests.
The defense may proceed.
Your Honor, I shall call no witnesses. This will be my testimony and my summation.
Take the oath.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do. Thousands of years ago, the first man discovered how to make fire. He was probably burned at the stake he had taught his brothers to light, but he left them a gift they had not conceived, and he lifted darkness off the earth. Throughout the centuries, there were men who took first steps down new roads, armed with nothing but their own vision. The great creators, The thinkers, the artists, the scientists, the inventors stood alone against the men of their time. Every new thought was opposed. Every new invention was denounced. But the men of unborrowed vision went ahead. They fought, they suffered, and they paid, but they won. No creator was prompted by a desire to please his brothers. His brothers hated the gift he offered. His truth was his only motive. His work was his only goal. His work, not those who used it. His creation, not the benefits others derived from it. The creation which gave form to his truth. He held his truth above all things and against all men. He went ahead, whether others agreed with him or not, with his integrity as his only banner. He served nothing and no one. He lived for himself. And only by living for himself was he able to achieve the things which are the glory of mankind. Such is the nature of achievement. Man cannot survive except through his mind. He comes on earth unarmed. His brain is his only weapon. But the mind is an attribute of the individual. There is no such thing as a collective brain. The man who thinks must think and act on his own. The reasoning mind cannot work under any form of compulsion. It cannot be subordinated to the needs, opinions, or wishes of others. It is not an object of sacrifice. The creator stands on his own judgment. The parasite follows the opinions of others. The creator thinks. The parasite copies. The creator produces. The parasite loots. The creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of man. The creator requires independence. He neither serves nor rules. He deals with men by free exchange and voluntary choice. The parasite seeks power. He wants to bind all men together in common action and common slavery. He claims that man is only a tool for the use of others, that he must think as they think, act as they act, and live in selfless, joyless servitude to any need but his own. Look at history. Everything we have, every great achievement has come from the independent work of some independent mind. Every horror and destruction came from attempts to force men into a herd of brainless, soulless robots without personal rights, without personal ambition, without will, hope, or dignity. It is an ancient conflict. It has another name, the individual against the collective. Our country, the noblest country in the history of men, was based on the principle of individualism, the principle of man's inalienable rights. It was a country where a man was free to seek his own happiness, to gain and produce, not to give up and renounce, to prosper, not to starve, to achieve, not to plunder, to hold as his highest possession a sense of his personal value, and as his highest virtue, his self-respect. Look at the results. That is what the collectivists are now asking you to destroy, as much of the earth has been destroyed. I am an architect. I know what is to come by the principle on which it is built. We are approaching a world in which I cannot permit myself to live. My ideas are my property. They were taken from me by force, by breach of contract. No appeal was left to me. It was believed that my work belonged to others to do with as they pleased. They had a claim upon me without my consent, that it was my duty to serve them without choice or reward. Now you know why I dynamited Cortland. I designed Cortland. I made it possible. I destroyed it. I agreed to design it for the purpose of seeing it built as I wished. That was the price I set for my work. I was not paid. My building was disfigured at the whim of others who took all the benefits of my work and gave me nothing in return. I came here to say that I do not recognize anyone's right to 1 minute of my life, nor to any part of my energy, nor to any achievement of mine, no matter who makes the claim. It had to be said. The world is perishing from an orgy of self-sacrificing. I came here to be heard in the name of every man of independence still left in the world. I wanted to state my terms. I do not care to work or live on any others. My terms are a man's right to exist for his own sake.